Today is Thursday, November 19th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Tropical Storm Iota lashes the Caribbean.
There's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people displaced by this Category 5 storm.
Also ahead, Australian troops are accused of murder in Afghanistan.
Today, the Australian Defence Force is rightly held to account.
Plus, the latest in the world's deadliest coronavirus outbreak. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the Caribbean, where 3 days after Hurricane Iota struck Nicaragua, the storm's toll on Central America is mounting, with more than 30 deaths. Iota was rated as a Category 5 hurricane. It has since weakened to a tropical storm after lashing coastal communities from northern Colombia to southern Mexico. For more, I reached out to journalist Megan Janetsky in Medellin, Colombia. Megan, can you first give us the latest on this storm?
Yeah, in Central America, we're seeing this tropical storm kind of wind down, but now the damages of that storm are really becoming clear. So we've seen more than 30 people killed, and that number is likely way higher just because a lot of these zones, we haven't made contact, or there's not a lot of infrastructure in these zones to actually get a proper, you know, solid death count. In Nicaragua alone, there were over 60,000 people that were evacuated. So there's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people displaced by this Category 5 storm. This comes just weeks after Hurricane Eta, which was a Category 4 storm. And for context, Category 5 is the highest you can go. And that came in and ravaged Central America and also other parts of the Caribbean, like Colombia's islands, weeks ago. In that storm, there were 150 people across the region killed and over like 300,000 people that were forced from their homes.
Now, you're in Colombia right now. What's the damage like there?
So they hit the Caribbean islands of Providencia and San Andres, and they essentially tore through the island. 98% of Providencia's island infrastructure was damaged, and 80% of the houses in that island were destroyed. So it was just completely ravaged. There are two dead, one missing.
And this has been pretty unprecedented for Colombia. Colombia's president, Iván Duque, said this was the first Category 5 hurricane ever to hit Colombia. Can you talk about how significant this hurricane or this whole hurricane season has been as global warming continues to worsen?
This is something that's really key in not just Colombia, but a lot of these Latin American countries. It's that they've already been disproportionately ravaged by the pandemic, and now they're being ravaged by these hurricanes and tropical storms. And if you look, meteorologists at the beginning of the year had already forecasted a very active hurricane season. And basically, there have been 30 named storms and 13 hurricanes in just a six-month period. So basically, what we're seeing is heating as the oceans kind of grow warmer. That provides energy for these hurricanes. You see a rapid intensification of these hurricanes. So it's not just about the frequency of them, but also the severity of them and how much damage they do.
And looking more broadly, has there been any international political reaction to all of these storms?
So you're seeing a lot of world leaders that are attributing this all to climate change. So Joe Biden has said something essentially, using it as an example to say we're going to try and stop the rise of these hurricanes. Honduras's president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, essentially said this: "We in Central America aren't the ones who cause climate change, but we are among the most affected. The countries that have recognized their main drivers of climate change have the money available." So they're saying that the people that have driven climate change for years and years and years now need to support those who've been affected by that climate change.
That was journalist Megan Janetsky in Medellin, Colombia. Japanese lawmakers voted to declare a climate emergency today. The AP reports that the emergency is a non-binding declaration aimed at increasing pressure for action on climate change. The declaration cites, quote, unprecedented damage, end quote, around the world from hurricanes, flooding, and forest fires exacerbated by climate change. It said the world faces a, quote, climate crisis, end quote. The declaration comes after Japan's government last month committed to a firm timetable of zero carbon emissions by 2050. European Union leaders are holding a virtual summit today. The summit comes as talks with Britain near a deadline over terms of London's so-called Brexit from the EU. For more, I reached out to journalist Henry Ridgewell in London. Henry, what does this EU meeting today mean for Brexit?
So the EU is meeting virtually today. There are officials in Brussels and each of the EU member state leaders is joining by video link. And we were expecting some kind of update on the Brexit process. This is one of the final meetings, scheduled meetings for EU leaders before the end of the Brexit transition period on December 31st. That is when things really start to change for Britain. Of course, it officially left the bloc on the 31st of January this year, but things largely have stayed the same since then to give businesses and governments time to adjust. But that all comes to an end on December 31st, and we still don't have a trade deal that might make those trading relationships easier, that might prevent much of the disruption that is predicted. And EU leaders were hoping for some update from the negotiators today, but they still seem to be stuck on the same issues that they've been discussing for several weeks now.
And so what does this mean if the deadline is approaching and there's still no resolution?
Well, it means that effectively Britain will leave the transition period on December 31st with no other trading arrangements in place. And that would mean not only the disruption from Britain leaving the single market and the customs union, as it will do under any circumstance, but also it means that Europe would put tariffs on many British exports as well. And don't forget that around half of British exports go to the European Union. It's worth several hundred billion dollars every year. And any exporter exporting, whether it be cars, agricultural produce, manufacturing, anything like that, across the border, they would face tariffs of anywhere from between a few percent to up to 20%. So it would disrupt trade dramatically if there was no deal. But it's also worth saying that even if there is a deal, there is going to be a high level of disruption. The idea of a soft Brexit, the idea of that kind of Brexit that we were talking about a year ago under Prime Minister Theresa May's leadership is gone.
So will this be at the top of the agenda in Brussels today?
It's not going to be at the top of the agenda. EU officials are joined by the remaining 27 leaders of member states to discuss this. We're expecting an update from the Commission President Ursula von der Leyen on the Brexit process at some point today. But it's not her and it's not the EU as a bloc that are negotiating. They have appointed one chief negotiator who leads the team. His name is Michel Barnier, and talks are ongoing between him and the British negotiator David Frost in Brussels. And currently, they're in what's known as the tunnel, which is essentially where the negotiations take place behind closed doors. There is no media allowed in. There is no briefing. There is nothing comes out in the hope that that kind of environment is more constructive to leading to a deal in the final days. So we don't really know what the outcome will be. If there is a deal coming, though, it will have to happen within the next few days or week. Otherwise, it just will be too late and we'll miss that deadline.
That's journalist Henry Ridgewell in London. Henry, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jason.
A four-year inquiry into Australian special forces in Afghanistan has found what it called credible evidence of the murder of 39 prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. Australian Defence Force Chief Angus Campbell released the final report today. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
19 Australian soldiers are suspected of executing 39 Afghan prisoners and civilians between 2005 and 2016. The war crimes report found junior soldiers were encouraged to shoot prisoners to get their first kill. Army commanders were condemned for allowing criminal behaviour, to be conceived, committed and concealed. The inquiry was conducted by the Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force. Over 4 years, it examined 57 incidents of alleged misconduct and heard from hundreds of witnesses. It found that none of the alleged crimes could be discounted as disputable decisions made under pressure in the heat of battle. Australian Defence Force Chief Angus Campbell says the report has uncovered a shameful record of a warrior culture by some troops.
Today, the Australian Defence Force is rightly held to account for allegations of grave misconduct by some members of our Special Forces community on operations in Afghanistan. To the people of Afghanistan, on behalf of the Australian Defence Force, I sincerely and unreservedly apologise for any wrongdoing by Australian soldiers. And to the people of Australia, I am sincerely sorry for any wrongdoing by members of the Australian Defence Force.
The war crimes report published Thursday is heavily redacted. The full classified documents will remain secret. Its allegations will be investigated by Australian police and federal prosecutors. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has said previously that Australia had to confront brutal truths about the actions of some of its soldiers. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA. Thailand's Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-Cha today threatens to use all laws possible against pro-democracy protesters. Activists voiced concern that his new threat could mean the resumption of prosecutions using Thailand's harsh royal insult laws, with jail sentences up to 15 years. Prayut's announcement came a day after thousands of protesters threw paint at police headquarters. The protesters said that was their response to the use of water cannon and tear gas, which injured dozens on Tuesday, the most violent day of protests since July. The protesters want Prayut to step down and reforms of the country's monarchy. Prayut took power in a coup and denies allegations of rigging an election to stay in office. And in Peru, the new president, Francisco Sagasti, has a cabinet in place to help him begin stabilizing the government. A day after the liberal centrist became Peru's third president within a week, Sagasti appointed Violeta Bermudez, a legal expert, to lead the 18 cabinet ministers sworn in Wednesday. Sagasti, who will serve as interim president until next July, replaced former Congress Speaker Manuel Moreno, who resigned Sunday after days of street protests ended with the deaths of two people. Moreno himself became president by default after the opposition-led Congress impeached popular president Martin Vizcarra over unverified bribery allegations, setting off protests and creating a leadership crisis. Peruvians will head to the polls next April to choose a president to serve a full term. Listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. America's confirmed coronavirus death toll has hit another grim milestone with over 250,000 dead from the virus. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
It's now over 250,000, yet another number that keeps rising. Newly confirmed infections per day are up 80% and up in every state.
From a linear rate to now an exponential rate of growth.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is putting more limits on indoor activities and is warning of another stay-at-home order if cases don't drop in the nation's biggest city.
We do need to close our schools.
New York Mayor Bill de Blasio says it's disappointing but necessary. Denver is also closing its schools. In Arizona, Republican Governor Doug Ducey continues resisting a statewide order to wear masks, but pointedly notes they're required most everywhere.
Please wear them.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
In a virtual event with frontline healthcare workers Wednesday, President-elect Joe Biden warns that his team is going to be, quote, behind by weeks or months, end quote, in the country's pandemic planning unless the Trump administration stops blocking the transition process. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara has the story.
As the U.S. surpasses 11 million cases of COVID-19, President-elect Joe Biden slammed President Donald Trump, who refuses to concede that he lost the election, denying Biden a smooth transition that would include sharing information about the pandemic.
There's a whole lot of things that are just we just don't have available to us, which unless it's made available soon, we're going to be behind by weeks or months being able to put together the whole initiative relating to the biggest promise we have with two drug companies coming along and finding 95% effectiveness efficiency in the vaccines, which is
during a virtual event Wednesday, Biden heard testimonies from health workers on the front line of the battle against the pandemic.
I'm sorry, I'm so emotional.
You got me emotional.
Earlier this week, Biden warned that more Americans may die from the virus if the transition is further delayed. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is touting achievements in vaccines after U.S. pharmaceutical companies Moderna and Pfizer reported initial results showing their vaccines to be over 90% effective. U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar.
By the end of December, we expect to have about 40 million doses of these two vaccines available for distribution, pending FDA authorization. Enough to vaccinate about 20 million of our most vulnerable Americans.
Despite encouraging vaccine news, Biden is facing an uphill battle when he is inaugurated in January. Catherine Baker is a health economist and dean of the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy.
I think the incoming administration is going to face a lot of challenges in terms of getting people to cooperate with best practices for public health while everyone is focused on exciting news about a new vaccine. In the best case scenario, it's going to be months and months before a vaccine is manufactured and distributed and administered to a critical mass of the population.
The Trump campaign continues to mount legal challenges in several states, including the latest demand of a partial recount in the state of Wisconsin, which Biden won. Patsy Whitaker-Swara, VOA News.
Health experts are worried that the U.S. outbreak could worsen further during the coming Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays in the U.S. For more, my colleague Lori London spoke to Dr. William Schaffner. Dr. Schaffner is an infectious disease physician at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He first explains why COVID-19 cases are surging in the U.S.
People are going out to group events, not paying attention to social distancing and not wearing masks. They wish to return to the old normal. And there's COVID fatigue out there. And those grouped events are accelerated. The virus is spreading among people who attend the group event, and then they go home, and the virus spreads further at home, and thus the virus keeps spreading, really, in a rather uncontrolled fashion now.
Do you see this getting worse with the holidays, with the colder weather in the coming months, regardless of any hope of a rapid vaccine?
Well, I'm very worried that the holidays here in the United States will accelerate this further because people will gather together and behave the way they've always done. That's normal. But it's a group event. People will be giving thanks and be giving the virus at the same time, I'm afraid. Mm. And we'll spend more time indoors because it's cooler and indeed will get cold. And once again, that's an environment conducive to spreading the virus. We'll wait for a vaccine, and we may indeed start vaccinating toward the end of the year, and certainly in the beginning of the year, everything going well. But it will take months and months and months before the frequency of the vaccination out in the population will affect the transmission of this virus.
Do you see this pretty much out of control at this point in time?
I think it is out of control at present and will continue to be out of control in the foreseeable future. Now, governors around the country are instituting restrictions of one sort or another in an attempt to curtail spread, and some of those may indeed have some local impact. We can only hope. Several of us are imploring our governor to put in a statewide mask mandate at the present time. We'll see if we have any effect. Not yet. So I think we're in a a quite perilous situation. This has been called the greatest public health hazard to affect the United States since the 1918 monstrous influenza pandemic. I think that's true. I don't believe that's an exaggeration.
Do you think that by the time a new president is sworn in on January 20th, it's not like he's just going to suddenly be able to get it under control at that point?
With a potentially different approach or new policies?
There'll be nothing sudden about this. This will be like turning the proverbial ocean liner, slow and persistent to turn things around. Some of the attitudes about mask wearing and notions about the pandemic are so baked in and have such a political veneer that those attitudes are very, very hard to change.
And what about these two potential vaccines that we've been hearing about coming out? How quickly, even though we're hearing, like you just said, maybe some of them will start being given at the end of December, what's the realistic timeline on all of this? And can we really believe they're that effective?
I do believe we can believe they are that effective. It seemed from the beginning that both vaccines were going to be over 90% effective once the data started to come in. And that made all of us smile. Effectiveness at that level had not been anticipated. So there is light at the end of the tunnel, but it's still a long tunnel. We'll have to do a lot of work to get there. I do think that by the end of the year, certainly the beginning of January, we ought to be able to start vaccinating. We'll give it first to healthcare providers who are taking direct care of COVID patients, people who work in nursing homes, emergency medical technicians, and those kinds of folks, the first responders. And then we'll open it up gradually to others. Over time, there will be a prioritization. We can't vaccinate everybody in a week and a half, and everybody will have to stay tuned when it comes their time to be vaccinated. But people will have to be convinced. There's a lot of skepticism about these vaccines, and I think the data are going to be so solid. And my prediction is those vaccines will be supported by medical and public health professions, and that will reassure the average person and will begin to persuade them to get vaccinated. Because if we, and who wear white coats, get ourselves and our families vaccinated, that ought to say something.
That was Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease physician at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, speaking to my colleague Lori London. That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe released a report exposing massive and systemic human rights abuses in Belarus perpetrated by the regime of Alexander Lukashenko during the fraudulent August 9th election and its aftermath. The OSCE report claims that the main purpose of Lukashenko's crackdown was to punish demonstrators and to intimidate them and potential other protesters. The abuses against peaceful demonstrators, opposition activists, and journalists include torture, arbitrary detention, and curtailment of freedom of expression, association, and peaceful assembly. Lead author and international law professor Wolfgang Benedek notes in the report that it is particularly worrying that the well-documented cases of torture and ill-treatment in the crackdown by the security forces on political dissent have not as yet resulted in anybody being held accountable, which is confirming allegations of general impunity, also due to the absence of fair trial in political cases. Mass demonstrations have continued across Belarus since the disputed election, increasing pressure on President Lukashenko, who has ruled for 26 years and refuses to acknowledge that the election was stolen. According to press reports, President Lukashenko has tightened his grip on power by partially closing the western border, replacing his interior minister, and urging security officers policing protests to intensify the crackdown on demonstrators. The United States remains inspired by the resilience and dignity of the Belarusian people, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement. The United States continues to call on the Belarusian authorities to cease their crackdown and heed the demands of the Belarusian people for free and fair elections under independent observation. The recommendations in the OSCE report provide Belarusian authorities with a means to end the crisis. The plan includes an OSCE observer mission, an end to the violence against the Belarusian people, and ensuring accountability for those found responsible for past abuses. Furthermore, all those unjustly detained must be released, and there must be a meaningful national dialogue with representatives of the political opposition and civil society. The United States stands with the people of Belarus in their quest for justice.